Welcome to this podcast from the Argyllshire Advertiser. We recorded this programme live at the general election hustings event organised by the young people at Time for Change Argyll at Lochilpedge Joint Campus on Monday, December the 2nd, 2019, from beginning to end. The hustings, which had an environmental and climate change theme, was chaired by Philip Price, and all four Argyll and Bute candidates attended. Rhea Barnes, Labour, Gary Mulvaney, Conservative, Brendan O'Hara, SNP, and Alan Reid, Lib Dem. This is part two of the podcast.
So, could each of the candidates please tell us how they got here tonight, what the principal form of private transport is, i.e. make, model, engine size, and if no emission rate, please.
Okay, so we'll do that in a second. Give you a chance.
I was going to say, I really want to answer your question, and I will get there. First of all, about the tax, was that one we saw on? There were so many different strands of it.
Yeah, so I think at the moment we are on the taxing of electric vehicles and then the charging in infrastructure.
Okay, I haven't heard anything in regards to taxing them from my party. In terms of the infrastructure, we realise that's a problem, but even from 5 years ago, I never saw a lot of this stuff going in. Maybe that's just me seeing it then, that's when I noticed it. But I think there's more and more charging points popping up all the time, and especially as well on the rail occasion, I think you carry, but there are these new bills that are starting to get them as standard as well. Labour has a fantastic new transformation fund, which I've mentioned, of $250 billion over the next 10 years, and part of that as well, stream of that will be towards developing renewable low carbon energy sources, but also the infrastructure that goes along with that. And that will be at the home level as well, the personal level, not just making sure that we can move towards renewable energy. I don't see, to be honest, especially with our plan with renewable energy, why we need to really tax it. But again, I'm sure that's something that will be clarified at a later stage. But do you want me to go straight down?
Just before we do, just finish off that part of electric cars and the mm-hmm. question in a second. I think one of the points about infrastructure, I think as a society, one of the interesting things to point out is that we went from horse and cart to petrochemical. We needed to build all the petrol stations, we needed to build tankers, we needed to create the whole infrastructure. Moving from petrochemical to electric, we've already got electricity, we've already got the electric power, and yes, we need upgrades, yes, we need more power, but it's a far easier transition. This isn't creating a whole new thing, this is just developing something we've already got.
May I also point out as well, it's just on the battery thing as well. I think that, again, this is not my area of expertise, but that there are fantastic leaps forward in creating batteries which we don't need to dig up lithium as well. And I've actually spent the time looking at the damage it causes. So, I mean, the technology is improving all the time. We just need to use it. So.
And then another thing about cities, I think. We can maybe come to questions about all of that. So the question here was, what transport did you use to come to tonight?
Shall I start?
Yes.
I use a bus. I actually don't get that. What was the other part of the question? I don't have a car, to be honest, it started off just mostly for the fact that I can't really afford a car, so it's so expensive, but then, to be honest, I just see the damage getting worse and worse and worse, and I hear them saying there's more cars than ever on our roads, so to be honest, if I can manage, I'll find a way, and if I can get around there and put during a campaign using public transport, then, it's possible, with a bit of a tricky move. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'm a motor dealer, so I'm going to start with trouble with this question. Tonight I came in a Subaru Outback. Normally I tend to drive a hybrid, usually a Toyota hybrid. My cars tend to change every 3 or 4 weeks, it's quite good from that point of view. But yeah, it's usually a hybrid. Tonight it's a 4x4 Subaru.
I came by car. It's a Vauxhall Corsa 1.4. I don't know the emissions, but I know it's in the £20 vehicle excise duty category, so that does put it low on the emissions.
I came in my trusty old Nissan X-Trail, which I've had for
well, since I took this job on 5 years ago. The reason I got it was because I did have the family saloon, and I nearly went off the road over the hill at Clacken in the snow, and I got such a fright that I thought I'm never going to do that again. So I got it 5 years ago, and it's never let me down.
I'm going to ask one question from up here because it relates to what's been said, particularly what Rio was saying. Is one of the things that I find very interesting doing a bit of research into this is the whole revolution of electric bikes and how that can open up a whole new network of transport for people. One of the big challenges of using electric bikes here, because I'm looking at it for my own business actually, is infrastructure again, and I wondered if you guys had any thoughts on, or any policies on, creating cycling infrastructure in our government.
Okay.
I mean, I think when you look at it, I think that there's potentially a business case there for that. I mean, certainly in some of the, you know, the bigger population centres that have got, you know, tourists, for example. I mean, you've seen bikes now in Glasgow. We originally saw them down in London. So I think that potentially what is, you know, is a business case there for doing that. And I mean, anybody who's been on an electric bike, and I was on an electric bike a few months ago, and they're absolutely brilliant for hills. And I think that's, you know, there's good sides of Argyll and Bute. The downside of Argyll and Bute is probably the enormous hills, and probably if you had an electric bike, that would give you some degree of assistance going up it.
Yes, I mean, I have tried an electric bike, and I found it great compared to a push bike. But I have no intention of getting one. For short journeys round Dunoon, I walk. For longer journeys, going from Dunoon to the next town, it would be far, far too far to cycle. In terms of infrastructure, the council in common with, and working together with the charity Sustrans, has put in cycle paths in various parts of Argyll and Bute, but it is very challenging to extend it because we tend to have main roads that are very narrow and winding, and often on one side you have a steep hill and on the other side you have a sharp fall into the loch. So actually putting cycle paths beside our main roads would be very expensive.
Excuse me, can I just contribute to that a bit?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, could the government or councils not insist, we've had major road upgrades, we've had new tarring, whatever, could we not say at that time, you must extend the sides of the road to include a cycle path? I mean, it just seems sensible. They're going to all the expense of upgrading the road and making it nice for us. Put in a cycle path while you're there. You've got the machinery, just do it. And if it's difficult, well, tough, just do it. And it takes government and it takes councils to be working together.
Putting in a strip of tarmac for bikes is not harder than putting in a strip of tarmac for cars.
That's right, yes, that's right. Saying that council have put in a lot of cycle paths, certainly in Dunoon the cycle path has been extended several miles out of the town. There is the, I hate to mention the Helensburgh and Barton cycle path that council has been trying to do for 20 years.
I'm just about to mention it.
I've never quite managed it. So yes, there's a lot more that could be done, a lot more that should be done. It's just flagging up there are engineering challenges in Argyll and Bute, but I certainly agree the council should be doing a lot more, but it needs to be in conjunction with external funders such as the Scottish Government or charities.
I mean, when I moved to the village of Carthus in 2004, and I was told that within a year or two there would be a cycle path linking Carthus and Helensburgh, still not there. You know, and I'm not blaming anyone in particular. There are issues with planning, there are issues with, you know, purchasing the land. there's issues with the topography. And that is probably one of the most straightforward pieces of road in the whole of Argyllan Butte. So when you start getting into incredibly narrow roads, as I think it was Gary or Alan said, you know, when you've got the lock on one side and a ditch on the other, they're already pretty narrow, and it's such a difficult thing to do. But it would be incredibly, I think it would be transformational if it could happen and we were able to do it. I mean, I can't think of a better way to get round Argyllan Butte. I can't think of a better way to attract people to come to Argyllan Butte. And there are pockets. If you go to Butte, you cannot get off the ferry at Rothsay without a whole, like, scores of cyclists. It's become a real centre for cycling, and it would be good if we could attract more of that into Argyllan Butte. But I think the issue of cycle paths, dedicated cycle paths, would be hugely complicated and difficult to finance, and topographically I think it would be quite a challenge. But I live in hope that one day I will be able to cycle from Hellingford to Cardross, despite my advancing years. I was young when I first got a bit.
Excellent. We'll go for another question. Yeah. Question is there? Could you, sorry, I made a mistake here. We have one person to answer.
Sorry, I was.
And then we'll come to you, okay?
Yes. Oh, thank you. I think my voice is a bit, like, doesn't project as much as yours, Brendan. obviously, our leader is very well known for his cycling habits. To me as well, cycling is very important. It's a lot of how I get to him as well. Labour's got some fantastic policies in regards to cycling. You have to bear with me because there are quite a few, so we'll have to read them. Which first of it is £50 per head per year on cycling by the end of the term, which amounts to £7.2 billion a year. So that's to fund infrastructure as well, your cycle lanes, which I think are extremely important. I don't see why there's such a difficulty to put in. The amount of things I'm obviously taken out by various cars, taxis and buses is beyond belief. We've also got a fantastic pledge to deliver what is approximately 3,100 miles of cycleways within the first term as well, to provide that safe cycling for people. So again, you don't have to risk anything now. And also £200 grants for e-bike purchases as well, and to support e-bike valley industrial cluster. This is just basically trying to encourage people to get into what you're saying, to use this fantastic mode of transport. In terms of my personal experience with electric bikes, to be honest, I wouldn't use them because I'm too lazy, and I probably just use the electric function like too much. I'm trying to get healthier, but I think it's a great idea, but I probably should have to use them. Thank you.
Right.
I came here to hear local solutions. I had a lot of lists, and I keep up with this, and I'm still doing lists. But I think a lot about this, and something I've never understood is the forestry. So the forestry build a lot of infrastructure all around here, and it nearly all almost connects places. So you have a road that goes nearly to Dunlap, and the forestry reasons are, well, good, you can't have the public all running around while they've got their machines in there. But timber's not always coming out, and for long periods of years. So when the forestry, why isn't there not government encouragement, maybe some help from the forestry? I don't know how that works, but why don't we have joined up thinking? Why have we got roads through the wilderness, almost connecting Main Road to Ford, almost connecting? You know, why can't people work together? It's going to be generally my approach.
And is that in light of using other forms of transport other than the car and making the same network?
Then cycles, there would be, in fact, shortcuts to quite a few places if the forestry roads were brought into play.
So is that something any of your parties have thought about, using public land, just broaden it out, maybe not just forestry land, but publicly owned land to overcome some of the issues you're talking about alternative transport networks?
I think it's a fabulous idea. I think most of us have. I mean, certainly, I don't think it's a fabulous idea to let public cars on these, but I think to open them up to cycles and to promote them as a fantastic way to see and enjoy a Argyllan Butte. I mean, I think a lot of us perhaps unwittingly, if it's illegal, have already done it and do it quite often. I just take bites.
I find the surfaces of forestry roads are quite often quite difficult to negotiate, but that could be made if there was some incentive for the forestry. To make the surfaces, I can't go into the details.
Yeah, I mean, my experience, I sort of find them quite thrilling. And in fact, I sort of can cycle on the road, I can cycle in paths, but if I want to walk into the hills and, you know, tank it down a steep forestry road, that's quite exciting. So, but no, I think it's a great idea. I think we should be promoting it more. Absolutely. And I think if you look at what Fort William has done and how it has sort of turned itself into the off-road cycling capital of probably Europe, you know, it really has marketed itself wonderful. And there's not an awful lot that Fort William has that I don't think that we could easily match. And there's a great project that's been talked about, the Noon Project, which has cycling and that off-road cycling, mountain biking at its heart. Which is worth looking into.
I'm not so interested in it as a sport, but I remember as a monk I would like to walk to somewhere.
Oh no, if you look at what the Noon Project are offering, then it really is quite exciting and could hopefully do for the Noon and Cowell what it's done for Fort William.
Yeah, well, in Dunoon, where I live, I often go for walks in the hills behind the town. And the forestry roads there are actually in quite good condition and quite often see cyclists. I mean, I don't envy them in their slow progress up the hill. And I certainly don't envy them in their very quick descent, but they seem to get a thrill out of it. So certainly, I mean, if the forestry roads around Dunoon are in good enough condition for cycling, then the Forestry Commission have really no excuse for not doing the same for the forestry roads in Mid Argyll. So, I mean, if I was elected, that's certainly an issue I would be happy to take up with the Forestry Commission on your behalf.
Yeah, I think the point's well made. It's all about the joined up thinking. And one of the things that you've got with the private sector is they've got to demonstrate, you know, a community benefit. You know, so when this school was built and the contract was let for that, then there needed to be a community benefit, you know, in terms of, you know, apprenticeships or any other things that the building company put into the community. Now, the Forestry Commission is a national organisation.
I've just been corrected. Apparently, it's now
through. It's in Scotland anymore.
Well, it's the same thing, it's just been rebranded. It's principally the same organisation, I would thought. But I think that the point I was making is that it is a national organisation. And, you know, if the point is that the private sector have got to demonstrate an element of community benefit in the ways that they progress their work, then I don't think there's anything that the Forestry Commission or Forestry and Land Scotland, whatever it's called now, can do exactly the same. So if your point is that they've done a road and the road is to nowhere, but by effectively creating another mile or 2 miles and actually takes you somewhere, then to me there's a community benefit. And surely a degree of common sense says that a national organisation should be coming to the party in that sense. So I don't think it's a problem, because it already happens in the private sector. We just maybe need to get that sort of outlook into elements of government agencies.
I think it's a great idea. I don't see why we've not done it already, because we're in a situation we need to come up with. I really want to say sort of unconventional, you know, solutions, because it seems fairly, you know, fairly common sense. I felt for it, and it's all to provide jobs and work. I think my concern is making sure that we're safe, just to make sure
that was the reason for the safe.
Yeah. Can I just ask what you would want to make it viable?
I think it's just something I've always noticed, that cement forestry roads go nearly to somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And in this age now, when people want to use bikes or maybe walk themselves, then, you know, it'd be nice if they... It's just that, I suppose it's joined up thinking,
yeah,
right across the board, actually. Yeah. But this is just one instance where I think why are people using machines to build relatively stable roads? Lorries, you know, we don't obviously want cars necessarily. very funny ground. But why can't there be a little cafe at one end where walkers can have a coffee, another cafe at the other, and you know, they could be joining communities.
Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of my time just through necessity in Paisley, because I go to university in Glasgow, split my time between there and home and Tynnell. But we have a cycle path that runs from Paisley all the way out to Johnston and beyond. And it's great, you can just stop, bridge a beer and all that, have a cup of coffee and a sandwich. And it's lovely. And I've used it as an actual form of transport to get out there, and it's sort of been tarmac. Like, I don't know if that's maybe something that you'd want done, but but at least made so that you
that would encourage people to start using it.
Yeah.
It's a shortcut.
I think there was, I'm going to do one more question from the group before they end up flipping Forestry.
Just on Forestry again, but I'm quite surprised, particularly two of our councillors sitting there, that they're not mentioned in the Scottish Access Code, where cycling, walking, horse riding is treated the same, and that's all available on Forestry and Land Scotland ground as it is. As far as linking up goes, there is timber haul routes can be used for that. For example, there's two in Kintyre which go from east to west in Kintyre. There's also one that goes from Eridan right down to Auchendrayne, so they are linked up. Mm-hmm. There's one that goes from Cochrenan right down to the Ford Road. So they are linked up, and people have the right to use them. So I don't know where all this negativity is coming to. I think people...
Well, that's negative, it's just looking to get maybe a bigger mix of routes. Anyway, I think we're going to move on because I'm going to get some dialing back into the bigger picture and some numbers. So, a new emissions gap report 2019 looked at the difference between our current carbon emissions trajectory and the emissions we can emit within our commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement. So it's basically saying there's a line on the graph saying where we're going at the moment and where we need to be, and there's a gap. So how do we sort that gap? And at the moment, we need to cut 7.6% every year to meet that gap. The question is, have any of your parties calculated a percentage of actual carbon that you'll be taking out of the system per year as a result of the policies you've come up with? So can you say, with this policy, we'll take away this percentage, and that's why we're going after that policy?
Can I just check, that 7.6%, is that the UK, or is that, what is that?
That 7.6% is the globe, as in the gap that we need to make, and what we're asking is, have you calculated how much of a percentage of our own emissions do we need to remove with your policies? Like, what are you going to achieve with your own policies?
Well, I mean, certainly, our policy was sort of stated at the beginning. In the UK, we've got a slightly different policy, 2050, which is carbon neutral, 2045, which is the rest of the Scottish government. How that translates into percentage, from over the next 25 years, I couldn't tell you what the percentage is. I mean, I think that's the bigger picture behind your question, or maybe it isn't the bigger picture behind your question, but at the heart of the matter is that, we can get to carbon zero, net zero, by 2045, 2050, or there or thereabouts. What about the rest of the world? And to me, that's the real challenge, because we're a tiny part of the world economy, tiny part of the current emissions. So there is we need to do what we can do, but we actually need to encourage others in developing countries to actually step up to the mark. I mean, that's why the UK has really got a very, very proud reputation in terms of putting money into poorer countries. And we've committed that £11 billion over the next 5 years to try and encourage developing countries to move away from fossil fuels and move towards things that contribute to carbon zero. And I think that's where we can do. So it comes down to, we can only do what we can do. And then all we can do other than that is to influence and to help drive change in the rest of the world, working with partners. And it's only collectively that we'll manage to make that happen.
Well, I mean, I don't have a percentage cut for each individual policy item. I mean, the aim is to reach carbon zero by carbon net zero by 2045, and that would be achieved by generating all our electricity by renewables and insulating homes and businesses so that we need to use less electricity, and in transport, moving away from the fossil fuel burning vehicle towards one that's powered by electricity in one form or another, either through batteries or hydrogen, but another percentage for each individual item.
I think where the first of the question comes from is to have faith that we're going to be on a journey that's going to get us to this end point. It's good to have markers on the way, rather than saying 2050 is where we're going to get to, we're going to do it by start. Well, 2021, we'll have done this and this will do this, 2022, and that gives us, I guess, I'm talking for people here, but it gives you a faith in a system that you can check, rather than just politicians going, oh, we're going to do it, don't worry, it's going to be fine, and then it never is fine.
Well, we have different policies will be implemented by a certain day. For example, at least 80% of UK electricity generated by renewables by 2030, and would be ending fossil fuel subsidies by 2025, the insulation program to be completed by 2030, ensuring that all new cars are electric by 2030. So it's not, it's not just every target's not 2045, there are other targets for different years along the way.
I think so. It's a very fair question, and you're right, you cannot just put down a figure of 2045 and then have no indicators as to how close you are to hitting that. And that's why the Scottish Government have said that they will, by 2030, expect to have reached 75% of that target. So if we're not hitting 75% of that target by 2030, then they're not meeting their own criteria. So I think it's important that there are markers put down. And if you put into perspective, 75% reduction in a decade is a huge ask. And the Committee on Climate Change have already said it is among the most challenging targets set by any government in the world. And so it's not going to come easy. It's not going to happen by other people doing it. It's going to happen by every single one of us, either willingly doing it or being made to do it. And I think that's how important this crisis is. So yes, there are targets. Yes, we are determined to meet those targets, but it has to, I think, have a mindset change in us all, that we are all responsible for hitting those targets, and we can't just leave it to government or someone else to achieve it for us. We are in a crisis, and we're all in that crisis together, and we've all got responsibility for it together.
Difficult question. I was sort of frantically flipping through it, also trying to find an actual system that we have, and I'm pretty sure there is one, but often that I don't have in front of me this evening. We do have a legally binding, what will be a legally binding target to reach net zero by 2030. But as I say, that is something you want to find out, I can certainly find out for you. And I do agree with Brendan, I think it is something that we have to understand that it is everyone's responsibility to do it. But I also think personally that it gets to a point where there is only so much that the individual can do, and it really becomes the tackle of the big polluters, as I mentioned in my opening speech, that's really going to make a difference to cut those targets, and they're sure to do that. So, thank you.
Right, another question, gentlemen. The blue shirt.
So, to put it in context, I'm in my last year of school, I don't have a job. I can't vote, thanks to the Tory government. I got an email from the other day from Ryanair saying it's like €5 for a flight from Glasgow to Poland. So there's all these, that basically, where are the economic incentives? And you can say, oh, we're not in charge of that, But in our Garland view, I've passed my driving test. I can drive to Glasgow now. Before I'd get in the bus, but the bus cost me £22 return to get from here to Glasgow. Now I can drive. What's stopping me driving? Surely you need a cheaper transport network. And when the guy asked, what's your transport, you know, how are you going to make this efficient? And all of you just sat there going, oh, it's impossible, you know, it's too hard. But what if you just made it cheaper? I know Labour are trying to make buses free for young people. Over 65s get it free. I don't have any money. Why can't I get the bus free?
So two questions there. I think there's one about reducing the cost of public transport to make it cheaper than driving. And I guess the second question is cheap flights. Do you have any thoughts or policies to tackle cheap flights?
After that, I think you made a very good point. Did you see it was offered £5?
€5 a side of the old Monday from Glasgow to Poland.
€5 flight from Glasgow to Poland?
Yeah.
I honestly thought those days had gone decades ago. I have not seen that €1, €2, €3 advert in a long, long time.
I didn't think it existed anymore.
No, I didn't either. I'm absolutely astonished.
I've
seen it actually because I cannot believe that Ryanair, particularly this time of year, are trying to palm off flights at €5. It sure wasn't like €250 to come back. Because I know that I know. I mean, I'm very pleased that the Scottish Government has looked again and reconsidered the air passenger duty, which it was intending to cut to make flights cheaper. I could see the thinking behind it, but it just completely flew in the face of our desire and our need to reduce this carbon footprint. And I must admit, I am shocked. I wouldn't mind seeing it later on if that's actually the case. You're right. That's why people drive to Glasgow rather than getting the bus. That's why people, you know, if they're leaving here to go to Oban, they'll jump in their car or jump in a car to go to Campbellton or wherever, because it's convenient. And we have to build up a critical mass that makes it viable for buses to run. And as I said earlier on, it's about running at your timetable and not their timetable. And I mean you as in the community's timetable and not our timetable, which suits the bus company. But I wouldn't mind if you let us see that. I'm amazed that still exists.
In terms of getting the bus, though, anyone can get the bus from Lockhill to Glasgow. They go several times a day, but it's so expensive, why would anyone want to? And if it was free, I'd see loads of my mates getting the bus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you guys can actually change something about that.
Well, I'll take it on board.
In terms of flights, I suspect that Brendan probably has got it right. It's probably £5 to get here, but the return flight is probably a lot more. But yes, it's so ridiculous that flying is so cheap, but it doesn't reflect the cost to the environment. So our policy in the manifesto is that for anybody that takes more than 2 international return flights in a year, then there would be a high level of taxation on, you know, we'd change your passenger tax so that there would be a high level of taxation for anybody that takes more than 2 international return flights a year. In terms of the bus travel, well, that's devolved to the Scottish Government. But I would certainly be, if I was elected, I'd be happy to meet with you and get some figures of the comparison between the cost of the bus and the cost of the car and make representations to the bus company and the Scottish Government.
Thank you, Alan. In terms of the, you know, the point about airfares, I mean, I take your point. It's €5. It does seem ridiculously low. and obviously that may be obviously before taxes. In terms of the other aspect of your question, which was round about bus travel, you know, Alan rightfully says that it is a devolved matter, and he would look at it. My own view would be to then look at the other aspect of your question, which is it's free. It should be free for me. It's free for pensioners. It should be free for me. And the point, I suppose, of your question is it's not free. You know, somebody is actually paying for that. And I mean, that's the thing about what we've seen in terms of the Labour manifesto. You know, there are so many freebies. You know, money off rail travel, money off this, free broadband, you name it. But ultimately, it's not free. You know, because everybody else will have to pay for it. And now that's either the people of working ages now, or that's your children. In the future, will have to pay for it as they pay off the debt. So nothing in life is free, and choices have to be made. I mean, I do know that obviously there is discounted rail travel. You know, there's a 25, I think they've increased that up to now 26 in terms of a rail card. So there are obviously discounts there as well. But I don't accept the premise of your question that there should be free bus travel because somebody's got to pay for it.
I'll come in half of another country, so in Milan, you can get a 3-hour, 4-hour bus journey, Milan to Chamonix. We'll look at this, it's £6 to get for a 2.5-hour bus journey. It's £9, it's £11 actually, it's £11 with a young person discount.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that then, you know, the Scottish Government, if they wanted to, could then subsidise it. But that subsidy is effectively using taxpayer money that could be spent on other things to subsidise that. Now, I don't think they've made that pledge to subsidise bus travel, and that's maybe something that you know, may well come out at some point in the future. But you know, as I say, the essence of it is it's not free. You know, we make choices in life about, you know, how we spend money on public services and how much we raise in taxation. And ultimately, those need to balance. And if they don't balance, all you do is just rack up more and more debt. You know, and if you're going, for example, going down to Glasgow and you're maybe looking to become a student, then, you know, obviously that's what happens in terms of students, in terms of debt. And that's not something that, you know, is sustainable as a society.
As you seem to be already aware of our policies regarding bus travel, I think it's insane that a flight would cost £5 when a normal ticket is going to, you know, it's going to set you back. I mean, I think my ticket was about near enough about £20 to come here, and I know it's not a huge amount of money, but for someone like myself who's just trying to get by, it's crippling, especially if you're trying to do business or education or just visit family. No. So I do think, especially for young people who I know some people disagree with this, but I think we have it really hard. You know, it's jobs aren't as numerous as they used to be, bills have never been higher. No, I think it could be something that really helps, you know, people get out. And I hear especially the Conservatives saying we want more people to work and stuff. Well, if people are being absolutely robbed before they even get to their work, then what's the point? So no, I completely agree. In terms of the flight taxes, again, that's something I'm not entirely familiar with, but I think that Andy McDonald did say that he was considering a possible rise in fuel and flight taxes, but again, how that will affect, you know, Scotland's model will be, it's difficult for me to say.
So we're going to, we've not got that much time, so the speakers here need to get away in about 10 minutes. So I'm going to ask one question by the rest of you, we've not touched on that. And then I'm going to go to the floor for a couple of quick fire questions. So if you could try and frame your question, so it's a short answer we're looking for, then we can get through a few more questions. So you can kind of frame it in a yes or no format. I know that's really hard, but if we could try and do that for the next round of questions, it'd be brilliant. But, as we've sort of discussed, and I think everyone agrees on, biodiversity, particularly functioning ecosystems, are a major way of mitigating against some of the results of climate warming. This country, so the UK, scores 189 out of 218 countries on our biodiversity. What that means is that the amount of animals and plants we could have in the country compared to what we do have compared to other countries We're down at 189. So I'd like to ask all of you three actions, keep it nice and quick so we can get through a few more questions, on what you do to reverse that catastrophic score.
I've got two in my head right now. Thank you.
I think I'm very much a big fan of beekeeping. It's not something we can do right now, but I think we have said that we're going to review all of the harmful pesticides that are killing off a lot of our bees and grubs. I think the figure was like 71% that they're killing off, and I've seen them speaking to beekeepers actually last week, and they've been seeing a lot more problems with that hive collapse syndrome. So that's something that we're looking at as well. I think we were talking about setting up 10 new national parks, which is fantastic because they provide jobs and that will help with the biodiversity and as well. And you know, planting thousands and thousands of new trees as well. And it's just not going to be a sort of stock standard fast growing pine. There will be an element of that that's going to be a lot more native species as well. Because if anyone, I'm sure you all have taken a walk in these fast growing, you know, timber producing forests, it's the forest floor is just completely bare or something there. So we need to plant our indigenous trees back again. I would honestly, if I could, I would see the entire Hanging forested again because it was the shape it was taken away in the first place. So I hope that's answered your question.
Okay, in terms of three, yeah, I mean, every party is committed to planting hundreds of thousands of trees. I think there's a bit of a Dutch auction as to who's going to plant the most trees, so I think that's a given that will be happening. I mean, I think there's other things that we need to have a look at ourselves. You know, in terms of development, I think we need to have a much you know, closer relationship with developers in terms of reinstating, you know, natural habitats. I think, you know, if you went back probably 20 years, there was no focus about natural habitats. It was a case of, you know, we need to build this school or houses or whatever it is, and we went across and built them. And I think there's an awareness now that we need to reinstate the natural habitats that we took away. Not just because what it does for the visible environment, you know, the things that we look at and see and smell and touch, but also what it does for biodiversity. So those are certainly a couple of things that certainly I would pick up.
Well, I mean, this in a manifesto, this would apply in England because all this is all devolved to the Scottish Government. So in this election, we can't change anything like that in Scotland. That's within the hands of the Scottish Government. But the policies that we do have are, well, first of all, planting trees. The figure that we've got is 60 million trees a year. We need to reform the Common Agricultural Policy that support payments to farmers. We would reduce the support payments to the larger recipients and redeploy the savings to incentivise farmers to carry out more effective land management, preventing flooding and combating climate change through measures that would increase soil carbon and expand native woodlands. In terms of fisheries policy, we need to ensure that sustainability is at the heart of the fisheries policy and the catches should be limited at that level that would allow the fish stock to recover and be restored towards its natural level.
I think the first thing we have to do is look at the use of pesticides, particularly is it neonicotinoids, or is that called
the absolute
destruction of the bee colonies. And essentially, if the bees go, eventually we all go, because we rely on the bees for so much of the pollination, or all of pollination, but if we do not look at how our use of pesticides in agriculture, then I think we're in big trouble. reforestation, I think, is hugely important. We've got to bring back the natural habitat. I know that the Scottish Government, these guys say it's a Dutch option, but what I would say, the Scottish Government are actually doing it. I think it's 84% of all reforestation that took place in the United Kingdom last year was done in Scotland. And last year alone, the Scottish Government planted or arranged the planting of 22 million trees. So it is happening, probably not happening quickly enough, but I think that there is a difference between planting a cash crop of trees and reintroducing native woodland. I think where you can, reintroducing native woodland would be a huge boost to the ecosystem and attract back those species who are currently in danger, and perhaps attracting back those who we maybe have to re-import that were once here. I think Alan touched on it as well. I think a sustainable fishing policy, particularly in this neck of the woods, we have seafood, the envy of the world. The world cannot get enough of it, although, and I apologise for mentioning the B word, post-Brexit, you know, how we actually get it to them might be another challenge. But we have to make it sustainable. We cannot kill the goose that lays the golden egg when it comes to our fishing. So I think in terms of fishing, pesticides and reforestation are probably the three things I can think of that would make a difference in the short term.
Excellent. Right. So first
one, if our Atlantic salmon and our Pacific salmon stocks collapse, then we're well on the way to destroying a couple of ecosystems. So you've just mentioned the fact that if we lose our bees, then we've lost a vital component of our ecosystems as well. So a couple of questions, really, I suppose, is Denmark recently announced a moratorium on the salmon farming industry because Denmark had decided that they'd reached a point where there was no more capacity to prevent limitless damage to the environment. In Norway, you are required to bring in groundbreaking and innovative technology if you are likely to be given a license to either expand or install a new fish farm. Possibly why we have so many Norwegian companies here is we don't apply that precautionary principle. In fact, we are looking to double our production in salmon farming by 2030. That is one statistic the Scottish Government does want to be held to. I don't see how that really squares with some of the joined-up thinking and the non-short-term policies that we've been told today. I'm afraid that one of our biggest problems is trust in our politicians. We were just told that nothing comes for free. Well, possibly if we'd invested in our oil industry and instigated a windfall tax, as the Norwegians did, we'd now be well on the way to creating the green jobs that people need, those 100,000 people that you referred to. And we might even be able to subsidise the gentleman's bus fares behind us. So obviously some things do come for free. So would the panel support a moratorium on the salmon farming industry so that we continue to have amazing habitats and the wonderful seafood that this country is famed for?
Yes or no?
Yes or no, please?
Well, I think it's an awful lot more complicated than a yes or no answer.
Not for Denmark, it wasn't.
Well, I'll tell you,
and okay, for Canada as well, just revoke licences of fish farming.
I'll be as quick as I can.
And we're looking at a collapse of salmon stocks on both sides of the Atlantic and the Pacific.
I am not in favour of a blanket ban on fish farming. Neither am I.
I wasn't talking about a blanket ban.
Neither do I support the unlicensed, unfettered. I think there has to be a piece of ground found in which sustainable fish farming can take place. There has to be incentives given and disincentives given for people who pollute and who do not innovate. I had a number of meetings with companies, and in fact it was the same people who built the tidal barge at Cockerdale Coral Bridge, who are doing remarkable work in terms of non-polluting and non-invasive fish farming. So I think if you can encourage that, then I don't have a problem with it as long as it's sustainable and as long as it's environmentally friendly. I agree with you, the pendulum probably, in fact definitely, has swung too far the other way, and if we can bring it back some way and that it is clean, environmentally friendly and sustainable, then I would support it.
Maybe it would be more sustainable if we're implementing the type of legislation in Norway, where, as far as I believe, Maui at the moment and one of their fish farms, because they've broken their limit of 1.5 sea lice per salmon, are being charged €33,000 a day in fines.
I wouldn't disagree, but what I would say is, obviously, this is completely devolved to the Scottish Government.
I agree.
But I do take your point, and I think that the fish farm industry have been for too long their own worst enemy, and if they're not going to change in order to keep up the provenance and the quality in which they trade on in Scotland's name, then I think they've got to be made to up that quality, and if they don't, then they have to take the consequences after that.
This isn't aimed particularly at you, by the way. I'd like to hear the answers from you.
Right. Well, the term on expansions is not saying that it's not a question of banning a fish farm.
No,
it's just
not
banning
true.
The expansion until new technologies come through.
I think unless you could, I can. Yes, I have huge sympathy for that. If you can prove that it will be clean and efficient and sustainable, and it does not, poison the seabed, then I have no problem at all in granting licences for new fish farm, as long as they meet that criteria.
Is that in your policies?
Oh, see, again, it's not. It's entirely devolved. So it won't be in anybody's policy because it's solely devolved to the Scottish Government.
Yeah, so we answer the last question. There isn't anything in our manifesto about fish farming. It's entirely devolved to the Scottish Government. So my answer to the question is, well, show me the scientific evidence. I mean, if somebody wants to apply for open a new fish farm, then they have to get a licence from SEPA, the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, and SEPA should be examining the application and should only be granted if SEPA are absolutely convinced that it would cause no environmental damage, it would cause no damage to wild salmon. So, if I'm elected, I'd be happy to meet with you, and if you show me the evidence, I would then take that evidence to SEPA. But the decisions have to be made on the basis of sound science.
Yeah, I mean, the key fundamentals here are sustainability and high quality and standards. If you manage to tick those boxes, then I tend to be very pro-development, because I want jobs in Argyll and Bute. But like some of the other panellists, I've heard your side of the argument. I'm sure if I spoke to one of the major salmon fish companies, I would get a different side of the argument. And in fairness, before I come to a judgment, I'd want to hear both sides of the argument and then make up my mind. So I can't give you a yes or a no.
I just find it quite surprising that something that's such a major issue in this county, both for and against, that people seem to be so uninformed.
No, I think in fairness to the panel, this is a UK general election. This is not anything that we'll have any direct or indirect control over. This is reserved to Scottish Government. And, come back in 2021 and see who's sitting here and ask them the same questions about salmon farming.
Or the Holyrood election in just over a year. Ask your candidates there.
I would support that because I think we need to do whatever we need to do to stop the collapse of our stocks. I think, again, I'm not an environmental marine scientist, but when I see a side of salmon in a shop for $1.99, I have to ask questions where it's coming from, what the environmental impact of it is. Done a little bit of reading on the matter in terms of the Norwegian problem, in terms of the chemicals and stuff that they're putting in, and just the way that the overcrowding and stuff and the disease that's rampant in a lot of these farms. I think John Fish is something that I'd be happy to be a bit more for to make sure that it's farmed properly and to ensure the survival of stocks in the short term. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. Again, it's difficult because it's a Scottish issue, but I think Labour's come out and saying that we would support a fair and sustainable approach to fishing, putting the focus on small producers rather than big producers. And I think that's what the problem is. It's been weighted too much in favour of big producers who don't really have a lot of accountability. And in regards to SEPA, again, I think I was wrong, but I think SEPA's had a lot of budget cuts of late, which makes enforcement of anything very, very difficult. So yes, you might need to get a licence from SEPA, but because of budget cuts, it makes it very difficult to know even if they're making a decision in that regard, I think. Thank you.
Okay, so we've kind of run out of time. Got a question? Yeah?
Thank you. I think we've all got a level of environmental anxiety as individuals, and as Philip talked about guilt, why is protecting the planet not at the top of the political agenda locally, nationally, and internationally?
Yeah, yeah. Really? Is that your one word?
Well, it should be.
It is tonight.
It is in our manifesto.
Only you can decide what's the top of the political agenda. You set the political agenda. And the fact that so many people are here tonight says that it is. If it's not at the top, then it's very, very near the top, but it certainly should be.
Right, I'm really sorry, we're sort of at the end of time.
One big one.
Okay, go on then.
I'm
thinking
that I'm a real scientist. I'd like to say, we talked the talk. Locally, a few have failed us, to get an area of pollinating plants. Nationally, the government have failed us. They can't even define sustainable. No more talking. Will you walk the walk?
And another question.
So, you see, what a lot of talk. Well, at a national level, the Conservative government has banned onshore wind. They've hiked VAT rate to solar panels to 20%, and yet a bag of coal still has 5% VAT in it. How is that forward in your thinking?
I think, as a government, I suppose it's probably do it to the Conservatives who are in power nationally. Is that something you see getting fixed, those inconsistencies, or...?
Yeah, I can't promise anything. I certainly wasn't aware that there was a differential, VAT rate between...
Solar panels at 5% and you had it up to 20.
Yeah.
You get coal at 5.
Well, certainly I wasn't aware that coal was 5%. And that's certainly not something that I've come across, you know. And in terms of the other point in your question, which was around, cutting the subsidy to wind and sort of onshore wind. I mean, I, in fairness, my own personal view is I'm not in favour of more onshore wind in Argyll and Bute. I think we've got enough. I think we need to look at offshore wind. And we need to look at tidal as well. I think we've got enough onshore wind in Argyll and Bute. There's probably other areas of the UK that certainly can do more, but in Argyll and Bute, you know, I'm not supportive of more onshore wind.
The ban in England is designed for national, it's a general election. Surely, talking about the credit being spent by 2045 and so on, if that's the comment, just says, oh, we've done nothing as far as we don't need to spend more time.
No, I made the point that I'm not personally in favour of onshore wind, but I do accept that we can do more in offshore and we can do more in tidal.
Do you have targets for this? Because I think the frustration is we're all hearing the right words. What we're not hearing is a commitment to we are going to have a percentage increase in wind to this value with this money.
As the man said, walk the walk.
You know, it's the same question you asked earlier on around about percentages. You know, we're committed to 2045 and to progress along those steps to get there. I mean, you know, if you put that in the manifesto, ultimately it'll be the people of the UK that will decide these things. And I'm quite happy to be judged by that. But, you know, climate change was not an issue 5 years ago. The point I'm making is, if you listen, you know, in terms of the public consciousness, we didn't have this 5 years ago. Yet it was on the agenda. But if you spoke to people about climate change, you know, ordinary people, it wasn't one of the top priorities. It wasn't one of the priorities, whereas it is now. There is an acceptance that climate change and the climate emergency is real and we need to do something about it. That is why if you look at the manifestos of every single party, if you want to shut it down, you can try your best, but you won't. But if you look at every single manifesto, there's a huge section within that manifesto on climate change. And I say, if you went back 5 years ago, it wouldn't be the same size. If you went back 10 years ago, it wouldn't be the same size. So it's now an acceptance that we need to do something about it, and every single party, my party included, is signed up to do something about that. And what I said at the beginning is, we not only need to do what we can do individually, and as a family, and as a community, and as a, within Argyll and Bute, and in the UK, we need to actually get others to step up to the mark, other countries that are much further down in terms of emissions and pollutions, the likes of India and China. We need to get them on board.
Alan, would you change the tax, the VAT on coal and so on?
Well, we would reverse the changes that the Tories made, both the restrictions they put on wind and solar, and we would reverse those restrictions. We would also reverse the VAT increase that was put on to solar. We'd reduce it back to 5%. While we're in the EU, we can't reduce it to zero because 5% is the lowest that you can put it down to under EU rules, but if we could put it down to zero, I would put it down to zero. In terms of, Philip, your point about government saying how much should be generated by wind, how much should be generated by solar, I don't think that state planning of that type is the right way to achieve results. I mean, the private sector is innovative, and what I think the government should do should be set incentives for the private sector. And as long as it's renewable energy, whether there's more wind or less solar, or more solar and less wind, is, I don't think, important. The important is that we generate enough electricity for our needs by renewables. So the government can set the subsidies, and if it looks as if those subsidies are not producing enough green electricity, then we increase the subsidies. But it's by providing incentives to the private sector that we will succeed and we will see innovation. The state is not good at innovating, and the history of the state operating on the basis of national plans just doesn't work. We have to incentivise the private sector, and the incentive, if the incentive's not working, then we increase the incentive.
Okay, Brendan, do you have any
quick questions? Yeah, I have always supported onshore wind development. I always will. I think it's the way forward, onshore and offshore. It's a view that has been made quite unpopular, or even more unpopular in many pockets of Argyll and Bute. But my position has been and always will be that unless there is a genuine reason not to do it, then I will always come down on the side of those who wish to see them built. Because there are not just other huge benefits for the whole country, there are huge benefits for communities as well. There are communities all over Argyll and Bute who are benefiting from having wind turbines. So my default position has always been and will always be to support it. And your point about walking the walk is absolutely right, because one of the last things we voted on before Parliament rose last month or the month before was on this issue of 20% VAT. This wasn't a Whitehall Mandarin or the civil servants that just pushed this through. This was put through by the government. It was opposed, it went to a vote, and the government whipped their MPs through to put 20% VAT on solar panels. This wasn't an accident. This was malice aforethought. And your point about walking the walk is absolutely right, because when it comes to it, they simply don't.
I share your frustration with a lot of grand statements, and it's easy, isn't it, to make promises and not carry them out. I mean, a lot of the issues we've discussed are devolved, so it's quite difficult for me to provide you with targets in that regard. All I can say is, if you look at our manifesto, many of our policies, you know, do state numbers, figures, and for example, you know, the amount of money we're going to put into the Green Transformation Fund, the part of the nationalisation of our energy as well, but, you know, the policies we've got in terms of bike usage as well, consultation and hopefully the banning of these pesticides, which are so harmful to our bee populations as well. You know, I think it would be very difficult if Labour was elected to not walk the walk on those, because we have been so specific in the manifesto. So, and also as well, as you know, on an individual basis, if you like, I have to I have to live in this constituency. So at the end of the day, I'm accountable to you, you know. So at the end of the day, I have to make sure that anything that I am advocating for, voting for, is going to benefit to this area. So, no, I would urge you to read the manifesto and see what we're going to do. Thank you.
All right, I think we're going to try and squeeze in one more question.
I think we've touched briefly on some of the points I'm going to mention, but I'm just going to mention them again. Over the past year, there's been strikes all over the world by young people on Fridays, led by Greta Thunberg. Scottish Youth Parliament's national campaign in June was selected to be environmental protection, focusing on reducing pollution. The UK Youth Parliament's Make Your Mark, which is their manifesto, when they debated it in the House of Commons sitting in November, they consulted on issues that were going to be in Make Your Mark, and environmental protection came out on top. So obviously, especially with the turnout in this room today, there's several young people here, which means it's obviously a very important issue to young people. To try and be brief, I'll phrase the question, will you support young people in our fight against climate change? If the chair will allow, I'll add in the word, how, and how will you support us?
Okay, I'll kick off. I think that the leadership that young people across Scotland, across the UK and the rest of the world have shown in this issue, it's been a joy to behold. They have taken this issue and almost single-handedly forced it under the nose of politicians and of governments and said, do something about it. And Extinction Rebellion, which has emerged as well, I think have been a breath of fresh air. And really, that's a terrible pun, but you know what I mean. I think what Extinction Rebellion have done is they have forced onto the political agenda, to the very top of the political agenda, an issue which I think governments, world leaders would prefer wasn't quite as widely discussed and acknowledged as it is. So I will continue to support. I was there on Friday with the pupils at Oban. I've met with Extinction Rebellion on Bute and in Oban. My door has been and will continue to be open to any group advocating climate change or climate action, and they will have my full support both inside and outside of Parliament if I'm re-elected.
Well, the answer is yes, and I would support it if elected in Parliament by advocating the policies that we've been talking about tonight. I was at the last big climate change march in Glasgow in September. If I was invited to come to any of the local climate change marches, I would be very happy to come along and support you.
Thank you. I mean, I've got to praise you know, your passion and enthusiasm and your energy, because you know, my generation, well, I'm 51, you know, it's taught us a few things. And there's, I suppose there's a lot of things that we've got to learn. I mean, I'll probably put my hand up and say there's a lot of things I need to learn about, you know, climate change and round about the various aspects of the science and all the rest of it. And I think the fact that you've got it on the agenda is a credit to you. I mean, I will probably take a slight differentiation between myself and Brendan. I don't support Extinction Rebellion and some of the chaos that they've brought to some of our communities and some of our cities. Yeah, I support the right of peaceful protest, but I don't support, you know, bringing in communities and what they did in London down there. I just don't support at all. In terms of, you know, strikes, I'm not generally in favour of strikes, especially within class time. But, you know, you need to find a way of making your protest. And I think you've done that. And had you done the strike on a Saturday, yeah, you wouldn't have had the same coverage. You wouldn't have lifted the whole debate. So you needed to make that protest in a different way. I think having made the protest, I would encourage you to get back into class because your education is absolutely invaluable.
It's not.
Just go on. Yeah. Just ignore.
Can I just say as a teacher that I actually really support the Extinction Rebellion on strikes in Kazakhstan? Yeah. As long as it's peaceful and as long as it won't cause any Ebola, I hope it's perfectly fine. Yeah.
Take away that we need you to do this. This isn't people
can't do it on your own. They need politicians to lead the way. It's not about what people want, it's about what we need you to do. So hopefully you'll take that away from us, okay?
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast and would love to know your feedback. Please email editor@argyllshireadvertiser.co.uk or use Facebook to send us a private message. This has been a podcast from the Argyllshire Advertiser.